You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what does folk mean and who gets to define folk music? A Wisconsin researcher tells us how a pivotal Bob Dylan performance highlights an ongoing debate in American culture. First, between now and the August 14th primary, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and on the morning show. You can find all those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Paul Nealon is a businessman running for the House as a Republican in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. That includes Janesville. Paul Nealon, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
We'll start with your elevator pitch. If you had 30 seconds to pitch yourself to your potential voters, what do you tell them?
I tell them that I've been a fortune-level businessman running businesses around the globe, and I've closed several facilities in Mexico and Canada and brought those jobs back to the United States, many of them to Wisconsin. So I'm an engineer with an MBA. I've been very accomplished and will work very hard, and I've worked very hard for the nearly 20,000 employees that I've had over my career.
On a related note, tariffs have been a big issue. President Trump has gotten criticism from fellow Republicans over some of his tariff policies. What's your view on those?
Well, my view on it is that I'm a strong supporter of tariffs, and as your listeners probably know, the United States was funded on tariffs and excise taxes all the way up until 1913, I believe, when the 16th Amendment was passed, and we had an income tax. So when we are at economic war with countries like China and other countries who dump their products here, what ends up happening is products that normally shouldn't cost as much as they do, like education, housing, many other things, we get a cheap TV out of it. We get some other cheap things out of it. When I say cheap, I mean inexpensive. But the reality is we economically are far worse off if we're not protecting our industries. And so countries like China, China can't feed itself. China has more economic output of durable goods than they can consume themselves. On the other hand, the United States, we can feed ourselves plus other countries, and we consume 80% of our own industrial output. So we have a much more balanced approach to our economy, and all those other nations really need to sell into the United States. So we shouldn't disadvantage ourselves. We should have a playing field tilted in favor of American workers, whether they're blue-collar, white-collar, or gray-collar.
Now, you'd run in this district before. You challenged incumbent Paul Ryan. He's not running again. What do you think, looking back at Paul Ryan's tenure, about how he represented this district?
Well, I think Paul Ryan, early on in his career, had the right ideas. I think he was for smaller government and was for helping people. But I think he was in that swamp too long, and the money and the power got to him, and so he started to drift away from what he should have been focused on, which is Wisconsin's first district. He wasn't even having town halls. I had close to 30 town halls since I announced June of last year, and I announced in June of last year because Paul Ryan was pushing the border adjustment tax, which would have treated all other nations the same in terms of tariffs, which is wrong. You don't want to treat your best customers like your worst customers, and so we should focus our tariffs on countries like China and others who are working against us. And that's why I ran in 2016, was to stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It would have turned the United States of America into the United States of Asia. And so Paul Ryan backpedaled on that in the days before my vote for the election. And then, thank God, President Trump signed us out of that his first Monday in office.
Talking to Paul Nealon, one of the Republican contenders in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District primary. You faced controversy since that last election over tweets in particular, pointing out many of your critics as being Jews and providing their contact information. Tweets that Twitter read as racist and banned you for led a lot of fellow Republicans to turn away from you. How do you account for all of that?
Well, just for a point of clarification, I did not give out people on Twitter's contact information. I gave their name, their Twitter handle, and over the course of 1 month, I tracked all of the people who sent me hateful messages on Twitter, only verified users, people who had the blue badge. And lo and behold, out of the 81 people that sent me those messages, a whopping 74 of them happened to be ethnically Jewish. And I'm an engineer. I make spreadsheets. I look at statistics, and I naturally look at trend analysis just as a matter of course, and I noticed that this doesn't seem even possible, that if 2% of the U.S. population is Jewish and 92% of the people sending me hateful messages are Jewish, that doesn't add up. And so I questioned that. I questioned why that was happening. And then separately, I think you conflated a little bit, or maybe I heard it that way, people who sent me horrible voicemail messages, if they picked up the phone and dialed my campaign number and left me, some left me death threats, I published their phone number and their message. And if they sent me a horrible Facebook private message, I posted their Facebook private message. The freedom of speech is a two-way street. You don't get to pick up the phone or hop on the internet and bash on people and not have that exposed. I think that's wrong, and I put my face out there to stand up against things like that. I'm all for free speech. I'm all for freedom of speech in both directions, which is why I filed the FEC complaint against Twitter just this week, and because Twitter is the de facto public square. And every time Twitter reprimanded me, I want to make this clear to everybody, every time I was reprimanded, it was preceded by several emails from Twitter telling me that I, in fact, had not broken their terms of service. So Twitter ultimately threw me off of their platform, even after sending me 23 emails affirming that I had not broken their terms of service.
Why is it important for you to highlight the Jewish identity of your critics to people who are following you on Twitter and elsewhere?
I was highlighting it because I was questioning it. Every single day in this country, blacks, whites, Hispanics, Han Chinese are criticized and critiqued for all sorts of reasons and all sorts of circumstances. So everybody, every race is criticized in this country for all sorts of reasons, every race except one, Jews. And it's a double standard. And so when somebody who's ethnically Jewish criticizes me, I firmly believe that I ought to be able to criticize them. So when I get questions, why would you criticize somebody who's Jewish, the answer is because they criticized me first. If you look back through the Wayback Machine and look at all the tweets, I never went out of my way to go after anybody, except Paul Ryan, and that was on his policies. It was not on his being a father or a husband or a family member to the Ryans or to their in-laws. It was only on his policies. And for anybody who was either ethnically Jewish or black or Hispanic or white or Han Chinese, if they attacked me or attacked America First, typically on the first time, I ignored them. It was after maybe two or three times that I then retaliated in kind, with the same level of response that they had given to me. So I don't see that as anything other than defending oneself.
Someone is tweeting at under the handle at Neelan1589 as Truth Teller. Is that you?
No, I'm not on Twitter right now.
You're not currently on Twitter.
No, I've been banned from Twitter.
Somebody,
which is why I filed that FEC complaint.
So somebody has been tweeting as they've used your picture in at least one instance, I believe.
Pete, there are so many pictures of me out there that I can't. How could I even control that? I mean, somebody, could be getting. I have no idea. How does a QAnon person send information out the way they're sending? I have no idea how that works.
Just in our last minute, to make a final pitch to voters.
Sure. I've lived in Wisconsin since 2008, with the exception of the time that my corporation sent me over to run Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. I've worked hard on behalf of Operation Homefront, which supports veterans, actually supports active duty service members' families. I'm an active Williams Bay Lions Club member. I've been a supporter of Safe Place, a women's shelter. I have donated tens of thousands of dollars, in fact, $50,000 in one shot to two Texas border sheriff's departments because they didn't have they didn't all have rifles and night vision equipment. So I care about my community. I'm active in my community. I'm active in my church. I'm active outside my church. And I hold town halls and take questions from everyone. I don't take questions that have been previously prepared for me. So,
and we'll have to leave it there for time. Thanks to Paul Nealon, businessman running for the House as a Republican in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. That includes Janesville. Businessman and former Army Green Beret Nick Pulse will join us at this time tomorrow. Between now and the August 14th primary, candidates on the ballot in contested primaries have the opportunity to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find those at wisconsinvote.org. When Bob Dylan walked on stage at the 1965 Newport Folk Festival with an electric guitar and a full backing band, many fans said he had turned his back on folk music. Turns out this debate over what exactly is folk has been happening for a long time. Rivka Mazlish is a PhD candidate in American Cultural and Intellectual History at UW-Madison and the 2018 Woody Guthrie Fellow. She was recently awarded a fellowship at the Smithsonian Institution to dive more deeply into the question, how did people in 20th century America define folk? Rivka, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is exciting. Can you start off by telling us what you're going to be working on with the Smithsonian?
Sure. So I'm going to be working at the Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, and they have a great collection, actually several great collections of material from folklorists, folk singers, folk fans, folk enthusiasts. And, of course, Folkway Records is there, created in 1948. It's been at the Smithsonian since 1986. And I'm going to be looking through all these materials, paying close attention to any claims and arguments made about the meaning of folk, the definition specifically of folk, and the value of folk for American society or for democracy more generally.
And that includes music, but not just folk music, right?
Right. Music is a big deal and probably the most exciting, but I'm also very interested in the academic field of folklore studies and how that becomes a professional field and the role that that plays in policing and defining what counts as folk. And, of course, the Smithsonian as an institution also played a role in defining what folk is by creating folk exhibits so people could go and what they chose to show as this is folk or chose to not show and say this isn't folk definitely played a role in defining American folk.
And there's a couple pieces at the Smithsonian that come into this debate. I guess there's a leather jacket and an electric guitar, both of which belonged to Bob Dylan. Can you tell us the story behind those and why they became part of this debate about what is folk?
Sure. So this Bob Dylan electric controversy is sort of the most well-known and probably the most dramatic example of conflict over the meaning and use and value of folk. The story is sort of itself almost like a folktale. You know, there's different versions of it. Different characters say different things in different versions. But it has the same theme, and like many folktales, it serves to create this myth or mythic narrative about the protagonist, Bob Dylan, but also about the development of American popular music. The basic story is that Bob Dylan shows up at the Newport Folk Festival in 1965. It's his third year there. In previous years, he played solo acoustic, looking directly at the audience, playing political songs. He had also played at the March on Washington in 63, so playing a lot of civil rights songs. But in 65, he came with a full band, a leather jacket, sunglasses, so no one could really make eye contact while he was playing, and played some electric songs. And the crowd was very angry.
We're going to hear a clip now of Dylan playing Mr. Tambourine Man at the 1964 Newport Folk Festival, the year before this controversy. Then him and his band playing Maggie's Farm at that festival in the pivotal 1965 year. Here's a listen.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following.
All right, not a subtle difference there. Pretty big difference. So why do fans and the folk music community feel personally betrayed by this change, Rivka?
Well, to them, the electricity and the leather jacket, the sunglasses, it symbolized commercialism, consumerism, capitalism, insecurity, insincerity, sorry, performativity even. You know, it's obviously it's a folk performance, but it seems like they're in costume. That's something that folk enthusiasts always wanted to stay away from. I want to make it clear that they weren't concerned about electricity because it symbolized modernity. I think that's a common misconception that people think of folk fans as focusing on the rural and pre-modern, which to some extent they did. But, you know, they weren't afraid of progress, especially these early 60s folk fans, but they really hated anything that seemed too commercial. And also the insincerity, I think, is a big deal of the sunglasses, that this isn't a real connection, a moment of everyone being together. You know, I think there's a lot of other things probably going on there, anger and fear politically about other issues that eventually, as Dylan toured all over the country and in Europe in 65 and 66, audiences routinely booed when he played electric sets. And I think there's actually a lot of political and cultural anxieties going into that. But on the face of it, it's the symbols of what folk is supposed to be against the commercialism, the performativity. That's folk music negation.
Talking to Rivka Mazlich with the UW-Madison studying folk, not just music, folk history. She's got a fellowship coming up at the Smithsonian to look at issues of what is folk. Rivka, Bob Dylan, he picks up the electric guitar. He's playing around the world. He's getting booed. Did he say anything about whether he cared about the authenticity of folk music?
He did, yeah. I think people might be surprised to know that he did respond. I think people have this view that Dylan didn't care about interviews or he just wanted to say crazy, silly things and throw people off. But actually, I believe he cared very much about folk. And in a few interviews in 65 and 66, he spoke very forcefully and clearly to these accusations that he'd betrayed folk or the folk movement. And basically, he said that by trying to own the meaning of folk and trying to prevent the folk tradition from changing and living, his critics, they were the ones who had betrayed folk. Even before this controversy, Dylan wrote a lyric, "I may look like Robert Ford, but I feel just like Jesse James." And Robert Ford is this famous killer of Jesse James, the outlaw. And so basically he's saying in this lyric, "I may look like the betrayer, but I feel like the one betrayed." And I think that describes pretty well what he went through in 65 and 66. He liked to call his music traditional music, more than folk music even. And I think he really actually believed that a tradition had to be living and changing or else it would die.
Is this a core issue in the among people who study folk traditions? Are we out there collecting these authentic artifacts of folk? They come from a specific time and place. Or are we studying a living, growing, breathing tradition?
Absolutely, yeah. There's always this tension among folk enthusiasts and folklorists between revival and preservation. So preservation seeks to preserve the tradition and almost freeze it in time so you can have it as an artifact of what was. But revival is about making something come to life and sometimes giving it new meaning in a new context.
One of the issues you said fans had was over the politics of what Dylan was performing and how that fit into folk music. You sent us an example suggesting that folk music doesn't necessarily have to be political. Here's a clip of "I Wish I Was a Mole in the Ground" by Bascom Lamar Lunsford.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tell us about that song and how it fits into the folk tradition.
So it's a classic folk song. It appeared on the Anthology of American Folk Music, which came out in 1952, Folkways Records. And it's, you know, lyrics are at face value, not political at all. I wish I was a mole in the ground. Later he says, I wish I was a lizard in the spring. You know, it seems to not mean anything in particular. But I do want to sort of press the question of what counts as political almost as much as I want to ask what counts as folk, because while that song is not compared to a union song or a civil rights protest song explicitly political in content, it could still be political in the context in which it's sung. Songs like that, sung at hootenannies or folk festivals where people get together and they're all singing and it's spontaneous and there's no one performer and then spectators, but everyone's sort of performer and spectator at the same time. That's democratic. And it's just part of the folk tradition is that it's democratic in process and in the way it's played, not necessarily in content. And also that song, I think it's just very mysterious. I really think that his voice, the banjo, it has this pull, and it can take you to a different place. And I want to argue that I think there can be something political in the ability to do that beyond, you know, it's not a protest song. It's not an actual song about, you know, vote for this candidate or, you know, my boss is stealing my wages or something. But it can have political value anyway.
Now, I look at modern pop culture, and there seems to be this argument over ownership. If, say, Disney changes the Star Wars movies, there's an element of ownership from fans who might protest that, or comic book heroes, things like that. You see similar things in the world of folk. Who owns it? Who decides what's in and what's out?
Absolutely. And actually, I think that Dylan felt like the fans believed that they owned him. Mary Travers of Peter, Paul, and Mary introduced him at a previous Newport Folk Festival saying, you know him, take him, he's yours. And that really freaked him out. He didn't want to belong to anyone. And actually for him, as a young man, getting into folk was a way of becoming himself and a way of changing his identity, and he wanted the freedom to be able to do that. And it was the opposite of what he was attempting to do, the thought that he could be frozen in time or that the folk fans could own him.
Rivka, thanks for joining us, and good luck with your research.
Thank you so much.
That was Rivka Maslich, a PhD candidate in American Cultural and Intellectual History at UW-Madison. We're talking about her upcoming fellowship at the Smithsonian, to look at how Americans define folk and folk music. Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find all of these interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we continue our interviews with candidates for governor. There are contested primaries for both Republicans and Democrats. Today, we talk to businessman Robert Meyer, who's running in the Republican primary against incumbent Scott Walker. Robert Meyer, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're getting the elevator pitch from all the candidates. You have the length of an elevator ride to tell people why you're running. What do you tell them?
I decided to run last fall out of a sense of civic responsibility. I didn't think our state could return to a state of political health and move on from this terrible bipartisan era we've been in without hundreds of thousands of like-minded, fiscally conservative, moderate Republicans represented in our representative participative government.
And how do you see your experience in business as a good background for someone running for governor?
I think it's especially important at this juncture that the next governor is someone who understands the economy and the ways that the economy is poised to grow from the perspective of someone like myself who's worked in industry for 30 some years, and I've worked in different industries, and I've been a serial entrepreneur. I've personally commercialized three intellectual properties that have been created with big federal research grants at major universities. So I know a lot about tech transfer. I've worked on a farm. I grew up in eastern Iowa. I've worked in a factory. So we clearly need, that would be a big change from what we have now.
Now, you're running against an incumbent, Governor Scott Walker. He's got a lot of support from the party, has a national profile, has raised a lot of money getting ready for the race. It's a tall order.
It is. But I think it would have been impossible 4 years ago. But I think at this point, we've had 7.5 years of his policies, and we've seen the consequences of this extreme, what some people have described as an extreme radical libertarian, doctrine-based policies, which is basically boils down to cutting taxes, cut taxes, cut taxes. We've had really substantial tax cuts for 7 years or more. And now we can see we're $1 billion behind in our investments in roads and infrastructure and education, and these are foundational assets to produce wealth over time. So I think that the economy is really tenuous. We could be heading into a recession. There's no plan to mediate rural poverty. The governor's almost not talking about the next 4 years at all.
You've described yourself as a fiscal conservative and Governor Walker as maybe an extreme libertarian. On a policy standpoint, what would you be doing that's different than what he has done?
I think this fixation on cutting taxes, regardless of what the consequences are, is something we need to just stop doing. policy-wise, we've seen that that this funding of public education has had deleterious consequences on the K-12 system outcomes and the and higher education. So I believe we need to fund public education as sufficiently as we can. And I'm really curious to see what the Blue Ribbon Commission's findings are going to be, which they're holding up now. They're not going to announce those until after the primary, which I was disappointed to hear. And then my focus really is on business development. How do we grow the economy in the ways that it's poised to grow over the next 4 years so that we can get back into a position to fund things? And then how do we return our state to fiscally responsible business practices, including setting long-term fiscal goals that are strategically sound?
Talking to Robert Meyer about his campaign for governor of Wisconsin. He's running in the Republican primary. Robert, Governor Walker and his supporters might say, okay, those tax cuts are paying off. We have very low unemployment here in Wisconsin, a lot of businesses coming here to do business, so why change that?
Well, we're really out of whack, and these tax cuts have put us really out of whack in terms of wages. And this might sound like something Democrats would say, except corporations in the United States are way ahead of, you know, way out of balance with the record profits, and wages haven't caught up. Our minimum wage hasn't been raised since 2009. The problem is we have so many hundreds of thousands of people in the state who don't have the income they need in order to invest, save, and have discretionary income. And so that puts us out of balance. So that has a real undermining effect on the health of the economy, which is a summative measure. And this is especially the case throughout rural Wisconsin. And it's also, you know, there's so many thousands and thousands and thousands of people who aren't on the unemployment roll, and especially so in our urban centers. So there's no plan to mediate that.
As you said, some of the things you say sound like what Democrats would say, and that's some of what they've been telling us here on the show so far. How do you distinguish yourself then from that field of eight Democratic candidates hoping to challenge Governor Walker?
Well, they're pretty much tax and spend Democrats, and so you're hearing about what they want to spend the money on, and Republicans historically focused on how do we make the money. And so I'm the only candidate talking about how do we grow the economy over the next 4 years, and then specifically there are three ways the economy's poised to grow. And then that's going to build revenue through and through and through the economy. That raises the tide. So we all want to grow the tax revenues. They generally tend to talk about raising the tax rates and increasing fees.
Mm-hmm. So what proposals do you think would really help boost the economy while boosting wages and also boost the state's revenue all at the same time?
We're in a unique position. It's a once-in-a-lifetime position to become the leading tech state in the Midwest, mountain range to mountain range, top to bottom. And the big venture capital companies on the coast, especially from San Francisco, they've been here doing junket trips in the Midwest. They're asking, which Midwestern state's going to be that state? We have every strategic advantage to do it. This is a destination state. We have the beauty of Wisconsin. We've got the interstate highway system, wonderful airports, and the university system. And then in the I-94 corridor, where there's a concentration of people with college degrees and the service industry. And so we have a clear competitive advantage over all the other states. And the Wisconsin Tech Council's really trying to drive this, but they're not getting the support from state government like we could. We also really, in my opinion, need to become the leading hemp producer in the United States again, because that will really give our agricultural industry a shot in the arm and spawn all kinds of derivative cottage industries, because hemp can be made into so many things. And then back to that I-84 corridor, like Tom Hefty, a retired Milwaukee business person, advocated 30 years ago. We need these four counties to really work together. And that's another big thing no one's talking about. We've got to work together. That'll build investor confidence. So those are real practicable things that we can be providing through leadership from the state.
We've got this Foxconn plant. Ground has been broken this summer. Is that going to bring in the sort of tech corridor, bring in the tech jobs that you're talking about trying to promote?
Yes, but the Foxconn deal is unique because we so terribly overpaid for the jobs. The deal wasn't negotiated from a position of strength. We had the best location in the United States. And so I think, talking with the 5,000 people I must have talked to getting my nomination signatures, the ones I got, people generally all agreed we've just overpaid terribly. And now we're seeing the cautionary tale consequence with the Kimberly-Clark negotiation. So all these companies now that are the companies that have have provided the jobs and been these bedrock companies that get into trouble or they're in declining industries. Now they have this absurd price per job concession to negotiate with. So are these jobs going to be terrific to have from Foxconn? Yeah, if it all materializes, but we didn't really need the Foxconn agreement and it was a disaster. And environmental concessions should have never been on the table. So really terrible precedents set with that.
You mentioned an educated workforce being part of the plan here. Governor Walker has talked about education. Some of his Democratic opponents have criticized his education policies. What would you be looking at?
Well, I'm an education publisher, and so I know a lot more about education than he would. You know, that's not meant to be a criticism. So when he announced that, that gave me an opportunity as a challenger to challenge him to let me debate him in education, and he didn't respond. And I didn't expect him to. But our education outcomes, when I got to Wisconsin, we were third in the United States on our National Assessment Education Progress test scores. That's the nation's report card national test. Today, we're 34th. And you can't relate that to the disfunding because it's been going, that's a 20-year trend where we've been flat in our outcomes, and then the disfunding's happened in the last 7 years. And Wisconsin is one of the last remaining whole language reading philosophy states. And this, coupled with poverty and the correlates to poverty, has caused us, is really one of the biggest reasons why we have the worst achievement gaps in the United States. So we just don't have leadership from Dr. Evers, frankly, in addressing the biggest challenge in education, which is literacy and these just terrible outcomes in our cities, but also other parts of the state. At the same time, we're not getting the leadership from the state. How do we address rural poverty and urban poverty, which are these big structural economic challenges?
We're talking with businessman Robert Meyer right now. He's a Republican candidate for governor, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for the candidate? Do you want to know where he stands on a particular issue? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Robert Meyer is with us. We're talking about his campaign in the Republican primary for governor of Wisconsin. He's challenging incumbent governor Scott Walker in that primary. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for the candidate or do you want him to weigh in on an issue? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Chelsea is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Chelsea, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I was just wondering about what he would do or like what programs he would establish for the opiate abuse in Wisconsin.
Chelsea, thanks. So the opioid epidemic in Wisconsin.
Well, thank you. When I was a young adult, I worked in an alcoholic treatment center, and I know I'm very aware that most of the incarcerated adults have a history of substance abuse. And I like Minnesota's model, the community health agency, substance abuse prevention, mental health, which has produced it. You know, that just isn't just a good social program to fund. That's been a fantastic investment because in Minnesota, what they've seen is that's contributed a lot to the reduction in incarceration and in, you know, the other negative consequences that happen over time.
Chelsea, thanks for that call. We'll go to Karen on the line in Oconomowoc. Karen, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to ask the candidate?
What I'd like to ask is for the candidate's perspective on health care. How will we be able to fund and support people who are uninsured or underinsured, people who rely on Medicaid? And also, does he have any ideas about how Wisconsin can address the significant disparity in available mental health services, again, particularly for folks who are uninsured or underinsured?
Karen, thanks for that call. A lot there. Robert Meyer, let's start with health care access and the uninsured and underinsured.
Well, again, going back to that Minnesota community-based model, I think that's a demonstrated model that really works. And then to the first part of your question, 11 Republican governors accepted the full Medicaid expansion, which for us would have been $190 million on top per year on top of the partial that we did. So that would have added up to more than $1 billion by now. So that meant that thousands of people just above the poverty line, adults and children, didn't get to be insured. So I think that's something that I certainly would have done different, and that would be a first step.
Tying together what Karen and a previous caller had mentioned, a mental health care, addiction treatment, and you were talking about the challenges in rural Wisconsin, they all tie together. There's not a lot of access in big parts of the state to addiction care and mental health care. Is that something you would have your eye on?
Absolutely. And my dad was a small town doctor in eastern Iowa, and he was the only doctor within 35 miles. And so now that's even become a bigger problem, challenge for people who have to drive long distances. And there's a terrible shortage of home health care professionals. So this is a big, urgent issue that I'm very concerned about.
Karen, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're taking your calls for candidate Robert Meyer. He's running in the Republican primary for governor of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or email ideas at WPR.org. Melissa is on the line now in Merrill. Melissa, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Melissa?
I wanted to ask the candidate how he feels about the voucher program. In the Merrill area, we've lost a lot of our public schools, and that caused our class sizes to obviously get quite large, and I was worried about my children falling through the cracks. So we found some good private schools in the area. But what I think is interesting is, even though there is a voucher program, we found that it's a very difficult process for the schools to do, and our private school is not one that gets vouchers. So even though we're paying for private schooling, we aren't able to get the vouchers through the school.
Melissa, thanks for the call. I'll bring Robert Meyer on this. So the state's voucher program for schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a staunch supporter of public education, and that we really, you know, in 2010, we were a top 10 state, the state contribution, you know, public school funded state. Now we're median because of the disfundings. And so there's really been very negative consequences, such as the increased class sizes. I'm really against vouchers. I think that they should be scaled back down to the level in Milwaukee and Racine where they were shown to relate to positive student outcomes where they worked, because they're fair. If your child goes to a school that just has terrible outcomes. So they were shown there at that level to work. Now we're in a stage of very much over-vouchering. So I think we need to scale them back down and then really support public schools to work.
Thanks for that call. Melissa, we'll go next to Carol on the line in Wausau. Carol, hi.
Hi. I was wondering what the candidate's point of view is on the proliferation of weapons, the AR-15s, and if he's going to take any contributions from the NRA.
I like what Warren Burger said a lifetime ago. He believed that America is well past the era where we have to arm ourselves to protect ourselves from the government, and that military weapons aren't recreational. And I think that, I support people to hunt and have, you know, weapons, own them for recreational purposes, but deranged people and criminals have ruined it. And so I think that everyone's just going to have to make a compromise and live with reasonable background checks and waiting periods. And I don't believe that citizens should be allowed to have military ammunition.
Thanks for the call. We'll go now to Darren with us in Green Bay. Darren, hello.
Yeah, hi. With Wisconsin roads being some of the worst roads in the country, and just kind of general infrastructure degrading throughout the country, I was curious that, if elected, what would you do to improve Wisconsin roadways?
Right. A lot of debate about how to pay for road maintenance and construction.
Yeah, I hate to say this as a Republican. I think we need to re-index or reestablish the indexing of the gas tax. We've got to have a dedicated revenue stream. Our debt service on bonding for road repairs doubled, which is unacceptable. And the American Society of Engineers now rank Wisconsin third from the worst in the entire United States in our road repair. So this has to be addressed. And here's a consequence of this extremist, we're going to cut taxes at all costs policy. The roads are a public safety issue, but we're a tourism state. People can't come here and break their car.
Thanks for that call, Darren. So some of the things you said, dialing back vouchers, reindexing the gas tax, the Foxconn deal, you're criticizing a lot of the things that Republicans in the state have been behind. In a Republican primary, what do you tell Republican voters in Wisconsin that says, hey, yeah, I'm a Republican, vote for me?
We have an extreme faction of the Republican Party that's been kind of forcing the rest of the Republicans to function as a Borg. And I just don't think most Republicans, and especially now that we've seen the consequences, really feel that confident in the governor's policies and the things that could happen over the next 4 years. Given this Foxconn agreement, we're going to be paying a subsidy. All of us are on the hook for the rest of my life, certainly, to pay a subsidy. So we've got to get back to good, sound, fiscal, responsible government.
One possible outcome of the election, there's a lot of ways this could all shake out, but there could be a Republican governor and a Democratic-controlled chamber or both chambers of the legislature. If you were that Republican governor with divided government, how do you see yourself working with the other party?
Almost everybody wants government to come back into the middle. You know, we're way out at the extreme with the governor's policies. And Wisconsin's such a wonderful state. I don't think that would be a negative at all. I think most people have share views, especially when it comes to having sound fiscal, responsible government, having good schools, protecting our environment. You know, there's not that really much. There aren't that many things that we really disagree, other than the, you know, the big wedge issues, social wedge issues. This is a wonderful state. We should be having a great time and running it, making Wisconsin the best place it can possibly be for everyone.
As we start to wrap up, what would be your day one on the job priority?
To get to know the people in the legislature and the heads of the agencies, really get to know people. So, because working with people, working across the aisle, you really have to get to know people. Find the common ground with the people who you disagree with fundamentally and idealistically. We need everybody that I talk to, they want Wisconsin to work together again and stop, you know, move on from this hyper-partisan politic.
And one quick message to people, we have about 20 seconds to leave them with.
We have a wonderful, wonderful state. Wisconsin has a great history. It's an important history. And Wisconsin's made history when people were all working together. You know, we have this progressive history. That doesn't belong to the Democrats, and it doesn't belong to the Republicans. It belongs to all of us.
Robert Meyer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you again.
Been talking to Robert Meyer. He's running for governor in the Republican primary. Firefighter and president of the Professional Firefighters of Wisconsin Union, Malin Mitchell, running as a Democrat in that primary, joins us at this time tomorrow. Profiles of all of the Democratic and Republican candidates for governor can be found at WPR.org/governor. Between now and the August 14th primary, we've invited candidates in contested primaries to join us for interviews on Central Time and the morning show. You can find all of these as they happen at wisconsinvote.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check out some of the top stories in state news in our Wisconsin News Roundup. The Milwaukee Brewers are in a close race for first place. They did some wheeling and dealing for the home stretch. We'll find out how they changed the lineup to make a run for the playoffs. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll add some spice to our summertime cooking with the author of the Spice-tastic cookbook, Flavor Walla. That and some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.